in the morning if you call. And I'll stand beside you as long as I can. I will hold back the evening of your sun, but I won't crumble with you if you fall. I will shadow the heat of your day, and I'll drink from the sweat of your brow. I will walk to the tune of your song, but I won't crumble with you if you fall. Come walk with me and hold to my hand. Touch me, let me know I ain't here by myself. Stretch my night dreams into my days. Stop short of falling apart if I go down. I will wait in the morning if you call, and I'll stand beside you as long as I can. I will hold back the evening of your sun, but I won't crumble with you if you fall.
The unmistakable voice there of Sir Tom Jones singing the song I Won't Crumble With You If You Fall, that was recorded at the official ceremony at the British Normandy Memorial last week on D-Day, the 6th of June. And this week we're going to do something different on the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. Normally we feature stories from the Great War, but how can we go through what we've all seen on the TV and for those of us that were there in Normandy, the D-Day 80 commemorations, without talking about them? I feel it would be wrong to let this occasion pass by. And so that's what we're going to do this week. We're going to look at what happened on those D-Day beaches and the airborne operation. And we're going to touch on what happened at sea as well in the next hour or so. And I'm going to do that by following in our footsteps. Last week, I was guiding, I think we had 18 coaches with Ledger Battlefield Tours over in Normandy. It was an enormously complicated tour, as it's bound to be on such an occasion, finding the hotels, pulling everybody together, sorting out the support operations, getting to the places that we needed to be at the right time. And all of these things had to work like clockwork, just as they had to happen 80 years earlier, on D-Day, the 6th of June, 1944. And we felt anxieties. I certainly did when we arrived at our meeting point at Stop 24 services near Folkestone on Tuesday morning, the 4th of June last week. I, for one, was really concerned about it. We've got a coach load of nearly 50 people. And a few days ahead of us, we really didn't know what was going to happen. We got a loose itinerary. We got places that we wanted to go to. We knew that we had to be at Bayeux Cemetery on D-Day morning itself D-Day 80 morning itself, for a ceremony that the Commonwealth War Graves Commission had put on. But we were so concerned about whether the ferry would run on time, whether we would get to our hotel, what the hotel would be like, how far away from the battlefields were we, what time we'd have to get up, where would people get something to eat, where would we park. And most of all, the thought that was in my mind was the traffic. There we were with a great big 50-seater coach, and the roads for people that have been to Normandy are so narrow along the coast, in and out of all the beaches. Would we get stuck? Would we be able to take people to the beaches? And if we couldn't, how would they react? All these anxieties had kept me awake, to be honest, for a few days on and off. And then I realised that other people had the same concerns and that we were working in a team. And then I thought to myself, well, hold on a minute. Think of what my dad used to say. It will be okay. You'll find a way. We will find a way. And we did. That's what happened. And then I thought back to how those service men and service women 80 years before must have been feeling, just as we were boarding our coach to go across on the ferry. We looked back at the white cliffs of Dover, and we knew that whatever happened, that we would return a few days later. But as those Americans and Canadians and British and all the other nationalities that boarded those ships and then in the landing crafts into those rough seas of the English Channel, they didn't know what was ahead of them. They really didn't. Many of them, as we now know, didn't return. Not on the same scale as on the First World War that we talk about. No, D-Day was to prove a most fantastic achievement. And what had I got to worry about? I wasn't going to be in a landing craft. I wasn't going to be rushing across Sword or Gold Beach with Germans firing at me. No, it was going to be completely different. There was no reason for me to be worried. And as it turned out, with a few hiccups, as you'd expect, the tour was a tremendous success. Not just for our coach, but for the other coaches as well. Everybody worked as a team. And so, along the way, we came across some incredible stories. Another amazing coincidence that I've talked about before on the battlefields. How does this happen? And it's about some of those personal stories that we looked at over our 3 days actually travelling the battlefields that I want to recount to you now in this week's episode. And as we made our way across the English Channel, we thought about those Americans on their ships playing dice and poker games. All were tense and pretending to be casual, remarked one British soldier. Bravado helps. Some of those Americans within the 116th Infantry Regiment were heading for Omaha Beach, and their commanding officer said to them, "Anyone who has butterflies in the belly, speak up now." It's said, I don't know how true this is, that a senior British officer on board Empire Broadsword provided an equally discouraging pep talk to his men. He said, "Don't worry if you do not survive the assault, as we have plenty of backup troops who will just go in over you." But on the other hand, Dwight E. Eisenhower, the supreme commander of the Allied forces, even as we listened to his words as we left Dover, they sent a shiver down our spine. This is what he said.
"Soldiers, sailors and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. the free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Stirring words there from the great man, and I must admit, when I played it at the time and when I play it back for you now, it still gives me goosebumps, and it must have really stirred those men and given them confidence as they waited to go into battle. It was a Major David Warren. He was serving with the 1st Battalion of the Royal Hampshires. And he said, I think we anchored up at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the Solent, and we sailed out past the Needles. Not a bad evening, not too rough, good visibility, and you could see other ships moving in the same direction as us. We could see the minesweepers that led the convoy ahead. I remember standing on deck and admiring the scenery. It seemed unrealistic that we were going to go to war in the morning. And Winston Churchill had said that this vast operation is undoubtedly the most complicated and difficult that has ever occurred. Now, I'm not going to go through the details of what happened in this military operation, because I'm sure that everyone has seen that on the TV over the last few days and read it in books. What I wanted to do, as usual for this podcast, was concentrate on the individual stories. And what better place to start our tour but at Pegasus Bridge, which at 0016 hours on the 6th of June, the men from D Company of the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, led by Major John Howard, took the two bridges over the Carn Canal and the River Orne, and what is now famously known, as Pegasus Bridge. He had a small force of just 181 men and a detachment of Royal Engineers. And, as we know, Major Howard managed to land within a few feet of the canal bridge, and within 10 minutes and 6 hours before the beach landings, after a fierce 10-minute firefight, they managed to capture all of their objectives. And in the cafe, Mr. and Mrs. Gondrey and their two girls, their two young daughters, had celebrated. It turns out that they hated the Germans. They'd been selling the Germans coffee, beer and food. But what the Germans didn't know was that Mrs. Gondrey understood their German. And the information that they were passing between themselves, she noted it down and she sent it to the resistance in Caen. And that's how Howard and his team knew that the explosives to blow up the bridge were actually in the pillbox. Vital information. And just 90 minutes after taking off from their RAF base in Dorset, Major Howard was able to send those famous code words, ham and jam, indicating that both bridges had been captured. And to find out how that landing went, let's actually listen to Major Howard. He's standing at Pegasus Bridge some decades later, explaining to his tour group what actually happened when they landed that night.
We were probably doing just over 100 miles an hour at that time, still airborne. But it's a well-known fact that when you actually touch down, you're doing around 90 miles an hour. We're still at about 100 feet at this moment, with the canal on our left and seeing the trees rush past. We knew from studying the photographs, aerial photographs, of this tiny field that it was going to be a rough landing. And even in the United Kingdom, where we always on training landed on airfields, there were always a few accidents of overrunning or landing too soon. All sorts of things can happen in those enormous gliders capable of carrying 30 men with their equipment. We are still at about 100 feet coming down towards here from this, with Corn at the back towards this thing, and suddenly there was a hell of a bump, and we knew that we had lost the wheels and we would be landing on metal skids. The skids were immediately under the glider, and in the emergency when the wheels went, we knew that we would be landing on them. As we touched down, the wheels left and we were airborne again, just for a couple of seconds, perhaps even less, and then zip again. This time it was very, very shuddery, hell of a noise because we were on the skids. And through the open door in front of me, I saw what I thought were tracer bullets and concluded that if we were really near the bridge, the enemy had been alerted and were firing bullets at us, because when you fire at night, about every third or fourth bullet is always a tracer bullet to give the man firing it a direction. It wasn't tracers. We didn't hear the usual whip you hear of a round, but it must have been, we concluded, sparks from the skids hitting stones on the ground as we came in. And I think ourselves, we realized at the time that's all they were, because as I say, we couldn't hear the whip of a bullet. We thumped twice like that, although Jim Warwick, when he speaks, always insists he made a correct three-point landing right in the corner of the field. He always argues that it was an absolute perfect landing. But these chaps here behind me know that it really wasn't a thump and thump and thump like that. Now, what were our thoughts? We knew from aerial photographs that they were putting up anti-air landing poles. The Germans, under General Rommel, were strengthening the defences all along this coast, and we knew that these posts are here. Although the glider pilots had said, in Warwick in particular, that we take this much off this wing and that much off this wing, and it'll pull us up before we get to the end of this landing zone, where there's an embankment, as you know, up to the road. And he was dead scared of hitting that embankment. And one of the grenades in our pouches, which had all been detonated, would have exploded on impact, and not only that grenade, but also every bit of explosive in the glider would have gone up. The thing we were most afraid of is a machine gun firing at us as we came in or as we came to a standstill, because there are only two doors. We've got to get out of that glider. And back in UK, we had practiced and practiced and practiced. Now, in those gliders, you're sitting facing one another like in old-fashioned trams and buses. You're in your safety belts. You link arms, butcher's grip, and lift up your legs and just pray to hell, because we know they're all in the hands of the glider pilot. As we came to a hell of a halt, I suddenly found that I was blinded, I thought. But all that happened was my spangled bowler had come down over my eyes and I couldn't see the door. I pushed it up and saw that the door had disappeared. It had telescoped. And at that moment, we landed at 0016 hours.
And then they took the bridge. There was one fatality amongst his team. The much-loved Den Bretheridge, who was commanding 25 Platoon, he was mortally wounded as he attacked across the bridge, firing from the hip. He was shot in the neck. And a couple of hours later, he died, and he's now buried in the Ranville Cemetery churchyard, a few miles away, just up on the ridge. And this churchyard is right next door to the main Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in Ranville, and we're going to come to that a bit later on. But in this churchyard, it was one of those where the first burials from the Normandy landings were interned, and their headstones are around the wall, the boundary wall of the church. And there's 47 burials there, one of which is unidentified, and there's also one identified German grave there as well. And as we walk round there with our group, we nearly get to the end of the line when we find the much visited grave of Den Bretheridge. Major Howard was informed of Bretheridge's injuries before he died, and he said, "It really shook me because it was Den and how much of a friend he was, and because my leading platoon was now without an officer. At the top of my mind was the fact that I knew Margaret, his wife, and she was expecting a baby at almost any time." Another man, Dennis Edwards, who's a sniper with the platoon, he said, "Every one of us was really distressed that Lieutenant Bretheridge should have been killed in that way at the very start of our mission. He was a man for whom we had the greatest respect. Like all of our airborne officers, He'd never asked us to do anything that he would not do himself. And as usual with all these stories, it's not just about the soldier, it's not just about the casualty. It's about the legacy and the family that they leave behind. We always talk about this on our tours. We always try to imagine, I always say to people, try and imagine the soldier stood behind his own headstone, and then behind him his parents, and then behind them the siblings, of which there was many all those years ago, more siblings than what people have now, and then the cousins and the extended family, and then think about their friends. And suddenly it's just not one casualty, it's many, many casualties, the people that have to live with the distress and the legacy of what happened to their loved ones. Denham was his proper name, Denham Brotheridge. He and Maggie had married 4 years earlier, and she was at home in Smethwick in the West Midlands, heavily pregnant with their first child. And just 19 days after Den had died, Maggie gave birth to a baby girl and named her Margaret. And it wasn't until Margaret was 40 years old that she discovered what happened to her dad. She said, "I knew he died in the war, but my mother had remarried when I was 4, and she just didn't talk about it. When my mum married again, my grandparents, who were Brotheridge's parents, didn't like it. I went to see them twice, but they didn't connect, and I didn't know any of the family at all. My mother never talked about them for whatever reason known to her. I can't blame anyone. It's just circumstances, isn't it?" She says, "I found out about him just before I was 40. I opened up the newspaper and there was this big picture of my father's group and it had Brotheridge written on it. And I said, oh my, just look at this." And then with help from surviving members of her father's unit, Margaret was able to piece together what had happened to him. And she said he was very much a person of the people. He wasn't a typical officer. She said, "I met his batman, who was an absolutely lovely man, and he talked about him being very likeable. He said he often thought he would get told off because Brotheridge would polish his boots for him. He would sit and talk to his men about football. I wouldn't ever have wanted him to pull rank. They respected him and they would follow him. A couple of men I met said they would have followed him to the death, and that's the best thing you would like to hear." And then from there, Pegasus Bridge, there was lots going on. There was reenactors there. There was people selling souvenirs. The bridge that now crosses the canal is not the original one, because the canal was widened in the 1990s. But the original one we could see, although we didn't go into the museum. It stands proudly in the museum grounds, and people took photos of it. And just before we left, the existing bridge came up and a small cruise ship went through, and it was quite a spectacular sight, mixing the technology of yesterday with the luxury of today. We made our way down then onto Sword Beach. People had the opportunity to actually tread on that sand, the sand that those men came ashore on 6th of June 1944, and we did that at the statue of Piper Bill Millin. There is a famous photograph of Bill shown as he's getting off the landing craft. You can see men in front of him wading through the water. You can see the tanks that have already gone ashore, but several of those men in that photo were shortly to become casualties. Now, Bill was serving with Lord Lovat's Special Service Brigade. When they landed near Colville, Bill was told by his commanding officer, Lovat, to come with him. And Bill was pleased because Lovat was over 6 foot tall and he would show Bill how deep the water was. And Bill jumped in and he was shocked by how cold the water was. And being Scots, he was wearing his kilt. Now, let's listen to what Bill had to say himself when he was recorded on the spot where he played his bagpipes. What happened on that day and why?
He came over and he said, to Lovat, "Good news, the Paris have captured the bridges at the Orne." Then Lovat looked round and seen me standing there. Gives a tune. Well, the whole idea was ridiculous because of shell fire and all kinds of things going on at the time. And it was mad enough, three of us standing there, we shouldn't have been really standing, we should have been lying down, really. But the whole thing was ridiculous. He said, "Give us a tune, Piper." And I said, "Well, it may as well be ridiculous as well." I said, "What tune would you like, sir?" He said, "We'll play the Road to the Isles." I said, "Would you like me to march up and down?" "Yes, yes, march up and down. That'd be lovely." You like me to march up and down? Yes, yes, march up and down. That'd be lovely. So the whole thing was ridiculous. Even the bodies lying in the water were back and forth, you know, with the tide, you know, the water was wafting in, they were moving back and forth. And I started off and piping, going about a few paces along there, and next thing it was a hand on my shoulder. And this voice, I looked around, it was a sergeant I recognised. He says, "What are you playing at, you mad bastard?" It's attracting all the German attention, all every German in France knows we're here now, you silly bastard. But anyway, I walked away and looked around, and of course there's other people up at the wall there. Really, like this, they're cheating, yeah. But anyway, up and down a couple of times, then this time I come down, I turned around, they're all gone. Didn't I say that was fast? Never even told me. But anyway, I seen some disappear away in the distance, so I caught after them, and they were going across country this time. So that was action on the beach.
Coming off the landing craft into the water and wading ashore, playing Highland Laddie.
Later that day, after we'd left and there were some other Ledger coaches there, Bill's son, John, arrived at the memorial, and he was quite happy to shake everybody's hands, look up his dad's statue that was unveiled in 2013, unfortunately, 3 years after Bill himself had died, so he never saw it. But it must have been quite a moment for John to see so many people come to pay their respects to his brave father. Most of the soldiers there were pleased to see him playing it. They loved it. One or two lost their tempers because they thought it was insane behaviour and, as he said in the recording, would attract fire from the Germans. But one German prisoner of war was asked after the battle why they didn't shoot at him. And he said, because we thought he was mad, we just left him alone. And then as we walked back to our coach to get ready for the next stage of our tour, we stopped to the magnificent statue to Bernard Law Montgomery, who was to become a field marshal. And again, I'm not going to go on about Montgomery's achievements, but we talk a lot in this podcast, as you know, about World War One, and in that conflict, Montgomery served with the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and he was mentioned in dispatches in 1915, but before that, in 1914, a sniper had shot him through the right lung. He then got shot through the knee on another occasion. When he recovered from his wounds, he went back to the Western Front in 1916 as a staff officer, and he took part in the Battle of Arras and Passchendaele. And his service continued before the war, and he was to become most famous in the Second World War for the victory over Rommel at the Battle of El Alamein. And everyone is convinced, Churchill in particular, that that was the battle that marked the turning point of the entire conflict. Now, although the traffic was very busy in and around Colville, when we got to Montgomery's statue, there was hardly anybody there, apart from a few people from the Royal British Legion who were doing their own small ceremony. And as we stood beneath the impressive statue, we listened to the words of Montgomery himself. And this is what he said to his men before the battle.
On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to every soldier in the Allied team. To us is given the honour of striking a blow for freedom which will live in history. And in the better days that lie ahead, men will speak with pride of our doings. We have a great and a righteous cause. Let us pray that the Lord, mighty in battle, will go forth with our armies, and that his special providence will aid us in the struggle. I want every soldier to know that I have complete confidence in the successful outcome of the operations that we are now about to begin. With stout hearts and with enthusiasm for the contest, let us go forward to victory.
Such confidence there from the great man. I remember as a child growing up listening to stories from my great uncle Bill, who'd served with Montgomery throughout the Tunisia, throughout the African, North African campaign, and he spoke very highly of him. The men loved him. He wasn't very good at politics. He didn't get on very well with his American colleagues. But I, for one, would have been inspired by those words. There was no doubt in his mind that the Normandy landings were going to be successful. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I attended a ceremony as a guest of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission at Brookwood Cemetery in Surrey. And it was almost a precursor, I suppose, to the commemorations for D-Day. And the D-Day darlings, they sang this song at those commemorations. And they sang this song, The Longest Day, again on the Normandy beaches as part of the commemorations. And it's worth listening to that as we have a musical interlude in today's podcast.
So young to walk away into the unknown. How did it feel to be so strong while you carried your brother home? How did you hold on through the pain? You lost your friend. You stayed so brave. How did you learn to keep the faith? And now there's bluebirds silver on the white cliffs of Dover because of you. Because of you on the longest day. day.
They sang that with tremendous emotion and passion, and as I listened to the lyrics there, as we wandered around during our tour of the battlefields, it occurred to me over and over again that every single person in this country and throughout Europe owes so much to those men that landed on D-Day that day. It affected our lives so much, many of us wouldn't even be here had it not been for the success of that battle that day, that landing that day, and what happened in the next 11 months. We must never forget that, and that's what these events are all about, I suppose. I saw lots of children, lots of local children arriving at Bayou Cemetery to listen and watch the ceremony that took place there, and that can only be a good thing. So important, isn't it? That's why we do all this, why we listen to these podcasts and watch the documentaries and listen to the music. There's still much turmoil in the world going on, and there always will be. There's always been war, there always will be. But the reason that we're so interested in this war and the previous war is because of who we are and why we exist. Without those two conflicts, none of us would be living the life that we do now. And as I said, many of us wouldn't even exist. And we then made our way to the main Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in the area. And as I said earlier, it's in Ranville, next to the churchyard where Den Bretheridge is buried. Over 2,200 burials, including over 300 Germans, and only 9 of the soldiers there are unidentified. Ranville, the village, was actually captured on D-Day. It was the responsibility of the Lancashire Parachute Division. The cemetery was began by the Royal Engineers after D-Day, and they put up wooden crosses that remain there until after the war. But then, of course, within a couple of weeks, the war moved on. Those Royal Engineers had to move on to follow the battle, and they left behind them just 27 graves. And they left those graves in the care of a 9-year-old French boy called Claude, and he promised to look after them, and look after them he did. And then at the end of the war, the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then, came along. They replaced the wooden crosses with the Portland headstones, and they started to bring in burials from all over Normandy, just not from D-Day, but from the following weeks and months. Now, with over 2,000 stories there, we can't tell them all, so I've just picked one or two to tell you about today. And these are all graves that we visited with our Ledger Battlefields group. The first one is a poet, a Major William John Fletcher Jarmain, and he was serving with an anti-tank regiment, the Royal Artillery, and he had a premonition of his death. And how he died, he went on a recce against advice and was killed by a German mortar bomb. And he observed at El Alamein, and the poem he wrote, I'm going to read now. He says, at a war grave, no grave is rich, the dust that herein lies, beneath this white cross mixing with the sand, was vital once with skill of eye and hand and speed of brain. These will not rearise, these riches, nor will they be replaced. They are lost and nothing now, and here is left only a worthless corpse of sense bereft, a symbol of death and sacrifice and waste. Now, had he known that all of us would still be interested in him and all his comrades, I would hope that he didn't think that the sacrifice was waste and that all that was left was a worthless corpse, because if it was, I wouldn't be standing by his grave reading the words that he wrote. And then in the next plot is the grave of a man known as Dixie Dean. And he was one of those commandos that was coming up the hill from the beaches on the 6th of June on D-Day to take one of the neighbouring villages. And we have a full account of how this enormous and very popular man was killed as they tried to capture this village of Amfreville. One of his comrades said, we continued on our bikes along the road. It was like a Sunday afternoon ride. Reaching the crossroads just below the village, Captain Wesley said, this is it. We turned in, we dumped our bikes and mortar bombs, which turned out to be useless anyway, as the charges had been removed. We formed up in our sections and went up the hill. I had a loaded rifle with bayonet fixed and a grenade handy. I felt very determined and was saying to myself, I don't know what I'm going to meet, but if it's wearing field grey, he's going to cop it. The advance was the usual procedure. The leading section went so far, got down, then the next one passed, leapfrogging each other. Nearing the top of the slope, everyone was all eyes and ears. We approached a wall where the road veered slightly to the right. On the left was the gable end of a house, and in the apex was a little window. Everyone must have been watching that window when a muzzle end of a rifle appeared, a badly trained infantryman. I don't know how many people fired, but the window just disappeared with the strikes and the rifle fell out. As we came round the bend, a Russian Maxim machine gun opened up. Ozzy Osbourne and Tucker Jennings immediately returned fire, but Wesley was hit in the wrist and elbow. Paddy Harnett through the arse. Dixie Dean in the guts, and Abbott had his leg cut off. We moved back a short distance down the hill. The soldier firing this machine gun must have been a bit nervous, because if he'd waited for 15 seconds, he'd have had two other sections of the troop in the open and without any hope of taking cover. Ozzy then went forward to get Dixie Dean, who was lying out in the open with Jerry still trying to hit him. He was a big bloke, Dixie, and it was not all nicey-nicey like in the pictures. Ozzy grabbed him by his webbing, dragged him back and gave him to me. Big Bill Garrett, the medic, had not arrived from the beach, and somehow I'd been given the first aid kit. I couldn't do anything for Dixie. Within 2 minutes, he was dead. He looked at me, and then he was gone. And we stood as a group, quietly at his grave, looking down at a photograph of that big, strong commando, and wondering what he would have been like had he survived to tell his story. Over to our left in the same cemetery as the sun now beat down, we went to see the grave of not just a man, but his dog. Private Emil Courtil is buried with his dog, Glenn. And both man and dog were serving with A Company of the 9th Essex Parachute Battalion. On joining the battalion, Emil had trained as a dog handler and he was partnered with Glenn. Dogs like Glenn were trained to jump by themselves before the handler, but only on the word of the handler and his word alone. One veteran of his unit said this: "I served with A Company, and in 1943, when training hard for D-Day, we were told that the company was to have a war dog. He was a beautiful Alsatian and everyone's pet, but as training began, we had to leave him to his handler, Emil. He slept by the side of Emil's bed and was with him most of the day. I can give some details of his parachute training, as I jumped from the same balloon with Glenn a couple of times. He was fitted with a parachute, which was normally used to drop folding bicycles, and was of course much smaller than ours. His harness was made so that it was held with the rear legs lower than the front. I well remember when we were in the cage under the balloon, our way up to 800 feet, Emil had to restrain Glenn from leaping out before we got there. When he was given the order to go, he gave a yelp and jumped straight through the hole in the basket. Of course, his chute was opened by a static line, and as I floated down, I could see him below me. When he landed, he'd been trained to run around and lie on his parachute to prevent being dragged along by the wind. This he did, and he waited until Emil released his harness. But then disaster struck, and a disaster of the worst possible kind. Because it's thought that it wasn't Germans that killed Emil and Glenn, but a British Spitfire. Emil had landed south of the town of Cabourg, well away from the intended drop zone and into this marshy ground, and navigation was very difficult. But Emil and Glenn managed to rendezvous with their brigade commander, who was a man called Brigadier James Hill, and they met him in the early hours of the 6th of June, and with 40 or so men that Hill managed to find, they headed towards the 9th Battalion's position, which was some miles away. And then it was during this march that the worst thing happened. And Brigadier Hill himself says, "We were walking down a lane when suddenly I heard a terrible sound approaching from the seaward side of the hedge. I shouted to everyone to fling themselves down, and we were caught in the middle of a pattern of anti-personnel bombs dropped by a large group of aircraft, which appeared to be our own Spitfires. The attack was devastating. Only Brigadier Hill and one other man could even stand. The rest of them had been either severely wounded or killed. Hill went round giving them first aid as best he could. He applied morphia to the wounded and he handed out supplies. He couldn't stay long. He had to move on. And he left Emil and Glenn killed together. Some days later, nine para, led by a chaplain, went to find and bury the dead. They found Emil and Glenn in a bomb crater, still linked by the dog lead. They were taken to Ranville and laid to rest in the grave that we were now standing upon. There was a nine-year-old lad with us called Maxwell, and before he even started telling the story, he knew it. He told the story to everyone that was gathered there, and when he did so, he got a round of applause. Nicely takes us on to our next story, because Maxwell and another young lad that were on the tour when we were in the Bayou Cemetery had found a casualty that they told me was 58 years old. And I told them to think about that, because when we were going to be in Ranville, we were going to find a soldier at the opposite end of the age scale. And there we found Private Robert Johns of the 13th Battalion Parachute Regiment, another para, killed in action on the 23rd of July 1944, aged just 16. And Robert came from Portsmouth. He was born in 1927. Lied about his age, of course, a story that we associate with the First World War more than the Second. Just 14 when he joined the paras. He passed his jump course in January 1944, and his commanding officer at the training camp said he was the youngest pupil on the course, but he was the best performer. After taking part in the D-Day landings, the battalion remained heavily engaged in Normandy, and it's said that Robert was involved in a main effort to prevent a German counterattack. 13th Para War Battalion for that day says the enemy was very sensitive all day and fired on at the least provocation. C Company were unfortunate in sustaining a number of casualties from enemy mortar fire. As a result of very accurate fire from 50mm and 81mm mortars on their forward positions, two casualties were also caused by a troublesome enemy sniper. Casualties for that day, other ranks killed one, wounded five, missing one, and Robert was the man that had been killed. Major Jack Watson, commanding A Company, said about him, "He was quite a big lad when he did his training, and it was only when he died that we found out he'd lied about his age." And as we stood there with those two young lads and their parents, I asked them to reflect that young Robert was just 4 or 5 years older than them when he joined up. And could they possibly think that they would be able to do that in just a few years on from them where they were in life? Not sure they're even old enough to understand what I was saying, but their parents knew all right. And then we went to the grave of Arthur Andrew Newham, a private in the Royal Warwickshire Regiment who died in the Battle for Normandy on the 20th of August 1944 at the age of just 22 years old. And he was from Southsea in Hampshire and married to a lady called Joan. And just before he died, he discovered that his wife Joan had given birth to a little girl. And of course, that little girl would never meet him and he would never meet her. But she did meet him, because as we stood at his grave, we looked down at one of those white crosses that was initially placed there in 1945. And who do we see but a beautiful little girl looking at her daddy's grave? And that was that little girl that had been born just before he died. She came to see him. She came to see him in Ranville, doing exactly what we were doing on that day, 80 years, 79 years later. I wonder what happened to that little girl. I wonder if she's still alive. I wonder if she ever went back when the Portland headstones were put in place a few years later. I'd love to know. If anyone knows the answer, please get in touch. And also in Ranville Cemetery is a man that didn't die on the beaches, is a man that died out at sea. With so much attention being paid to the infantry and the commandos and everybody else that was making their way across the beaches, we forget that not just on D-Day, but in the weeks following, that men were still dying out at sea. And one of those was a man that came from my hometown, from Northampton. Jack Barringer had already served a tour of duty in the Far East at Singapore and Java. When he came back to Northampton in September 1943, he got married and then he went off to train for D-Day and join Her Majesty's Landing Craft Headquarters. It was a relatively small 400-ton ship that had been converted from a landing craft into a radio communications and command centre to take part in the assault. And Jack was on board this ship. No doubt he was quite anxious because he was newly wed. He was no doubt missing his family, and he was probably traumatised by what had happened in the Far East. His brother George, also a signaller with the Royal Navy, had been killed earlier in the year. He has no known grave and is remembered on the Chatham War Memorial. And Jack's father, called John, had been awarded the Military Medal and mentioned in dispatches while serving with the 2nd Links in the World War I. But eventually, John, Jack's father, succumbed to the wounds and illness that he'd picked up in the Great War and died in 1938. But on board his ship, Jack was really fortunate, like others, to receive support from many people, including his new wife, Betty. Jack had another brother called Les, and he confided with him. He says, "The place we are at now," and he's talking about D-Day, "isn't any good for your health, but we are managing, you understand. When we crept up to the coast, we could see the houses, the church spires, and all was very still. Too still, get me. Then it broke. Phew, what a hell of bombardment that was. Shells everywhere. We had a narrow escape yesterday." 10 days later, his landing craft exploded and sank after being struck by a mine, with the loss of most of the crew. And unusually, Jack's remains were recovered from the sea on the other side of Oysterham. And on the 1st of October 1945, his remains were relocated to where we were standing on that day. But at first, his identity wasn't established, and his name wasn't entered until February 1946, when it was established exactly who he was. Until then, he was listed simply as a British sailor. And the newspaper reported what had happened. It says, "Mrs. Barringer of Randall Road has received official news that her husband, Jack Barringer, leading telegraphist with the Royal Navy, is now presumed killed whilst on active service. After leaving Spencer School, he was employed by Messrs. Klitz, pianoforte dealers of St. Giles Street, until he joined the Royal Navy just before the outbreak of war. Son of the late John Barringer and Mrs. White of Ambush Street, he was one of three brothers who joined the Royal Navy. George was a signaller who was killed last March." Jack's mum was called Annie. She got a lot to bear. Her husband had died in 1938. One son, George, aged 22, had been killed. And now poor Jack had died. And once again, there we were, paying our respects. And we looked down at the family inscription on his grave. And it says, "His memory we shall always treasure. In our hearts, we will love forever." And as we did so, we look at a posed photograph of Jack in a studio, leaning on a wooden chair in his full Royal Navy uniform, a youthful, optimistic smile on his face. But sadly, he was only married for 8 months. And while we were on Juno Beach, we passed St Albans-sur-Mer, and we thought about two brothers that died and are buried together in one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, Ryers War Cemetery. Robert Casson was called up on St Valentine's Day 1940 and reported to the Royal Marines Reserve Depot in Devon. And he was posted as a cook. In September 1943, he reverted to the rank of Marine and he volunteered to train as a commando. From the 1st to the 4th of June, he was stationed in Southampton and they received the briefing. They embarked for Normandy on HMS Tormentor near Southampton on the 5th of June. And his unit was to land where we were at St Albans-sur-Mer, a lovely picturesque seaside town now. They were part of the Special Service Brigade that was going to support the Canadians here. Weren't all Canadians that landed on Juno Beach. I think I read there was about 30% of them were British. He never came ashore because he was shot in the neck and died instantly as his landing craft approached the beach. He was initially buried at sea, but after the storm that affected that part of Normandy on the 19th of June, his body was washed up on the shore and he was temporarily buried by the seawall there. He was subsequently exhumed on the 9th of August 1944, where he was taken to where he lies in peace now. His mother, Mrs. Mary Casson, received confirmation of his and his younger brother's death in letters that were just one day apart, the 17th and the 18th of August 1944. And then she learnt later that his body had been washed up on the beach. And she wrote letters and exchanged correspondence with the commission and requested that her two sons had been buried apart, that they should now be buried together. So the other brother, Joseph, although Mum was notified in the middle of July that both had died, their deaths are actually 3 weeks apart. Joseph had enlisted in the Territorial Army, and he formally enlisted in November of 1943, and he was initially assigned to the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, but was transferred to the 9th Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry on the 28th of March 1944, and that battalion moved down to a wood near Southampton on the 2nd of June 1944, and that tells us that Joseph and Robert, although serving with two different units, were both at Southampton as they departed for D-Day. Joseph's unit landed on Gold Beach, the second wave to land. The beach was secure and they pushed inland. The day after D-Day, they reached the outskirts of Bayeux, and in the following week, they advanced past Bayeux. On the 14th of June 1944, they fought in Operation Perch. The battalion went on to Tilly the 20th of June 1944, and Joseph has been recorded as being wounded on the following day. He was moved to a casualty clearing station, but he died from his wounds a week later. He was buried in the small cemetery known as Jerusalem War Cemetery, close to where he died. On the 13th of November 1944, his remains were exhumed. On the 1st of December 1944, the War Office wrote to Mrs. Casson and confirmed that her two sons were now interned side by side. Now, Robert's the first one that we talk about. He's had three headstones over his grave. The first one incorrectly attributed him to the 45 Royal Marine Commando. That was replaced with the 46 Royal Marine Commando in 2018, but that was also proved to be incorrect. And it was eventually established that the 4th Special Service Brigade was his unit, and the final headstone, that if you go to that cemetery that you'll see there, it was erected as recently as 2021. But had it not been for his mum, his remains may have been lost, because, as we said earlier, he was buried by the seawall at St Albans-sur-Mer, where his body was washed ashore. Thankfully, that's not the case. Thankfully, both of those young lads have now got a grave where they can lie in peace together forever and ever and ever. On the evening of the 5th of June last week, in the Bayeux Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, as the sun went down, the cemetery, every grave in the cemetery was lit up, and there was a very special event held. And we're going to end this week's podcast by listening to a song sang by a man called Jack Savaretti. He calls his song Soldier's Eyes.
To keep on. true. Yes, I know. With a soldier's eye, with a soldier's eye, with a soldier's eye, with a soldier's eyes, I've seen inside the devil's dreams where young men die. Graveyards open up their arms, mothers left to cry. I have seen the bleeding, and I know what we've done. Just like every other man, yeah, I'll keep marching on. Because I know I'll be coming home soon. Yes, I know I'll be coming home soon. With a soldier's eye, with a soldier's eye, with a soldier's eye.
Absolutely stunning music and lyrics there, aren't they? And there was so much music that we heard over the few days that we were in Normandy last week. It all brought tears to our eyes, as did the stories that I've told this week. And I was going to record just one podcast, one episode, about what we experienced in Normandy. But I've run out of time. I've spoken for over an hour already, and that's too long. But in my folder here, I've got many more stories to tell. Stories that I told to the group of Ledger customers last week, and I'll tell to another group of, not this weekend, but next weekend, when we head back to those Normandy beaches. And I want to tell these stories to you as well. So I'm going to record at least one more episode about the D-Day stories, the Normandy stories, and maybe even a third edition as well, a third episode. It's important that we tell these stories. Some of them have never been told before. Some are quite well known, but a lot are not. We've got the story of Stan Hollis, the man who won the Victoria Cross on D-Day. We've got his story to tell. We've got some nurses that were killed on board a hospital ship. We've got the story of Bill Pendle, the man who was chosen to represent the veterans, the Normandy Arromanche D-Day Garden. We tell his story, we listen to his words, his story. On Gold Beach, we talk about my old mate, Harry Austin. He told me his story about what happened when he landed there on D-Day in the second wave with the 2nd Essex Battalion. And we go to the tank known as 1 Charlie, just off Juno Beach. And we listen to the story of William Dunn and what happened to him and his tank crew, and how it affected the rest of his life. So many more stories to tell. So many more stories that we mustn't forget. And just a few of the stories that we told last week. There's many more. We go inland. We look at what happened when the breakout from the Normandy beaches occurred. And the horror on Hill 112, which for a few weeks in the summer of 1944 resembled the trenches that we saw on the Western Front a generation earlier. So that's it for now. I told a handful of stories this week of the men buried in Ranville Cemetery, of the man who became the first casualty on D-Day, who was buried in the Ranville Churchyard Cemetery. And for all of those men, and the thousands that others that fell on D-Day and beyond, we end as usual by the playing of The Last Post.